Betty meant everything to me. And I think to really understand why, I need to share a little bit about my background and how I grew up. For the first half of my childhood, my dad was an alcoholic. And he wasn't a violent alcoholic, he was a depressive alcoholic. And some of my earliest memories was my dad passed out on the floor, and my brother and I used to take our matchbox cars, and we would drive them through the little grooves in his corduroy pants. It was like little roads, and it was like our way of having a connection with my dad. And then in the 80s, when the moral majority swept through America, my mom got my dad saved, and then we were saved. We were Christian fundamentalists. And my dad, you know, traded one addiction, which was, you know, drinking and blacking out, with religion, his new addiction. But the energy in the home felt the same. And so I grew up on the South Shore of Long Island, very cosmopolitan. But my parents got deeper and deeper into what you would consider a cult. So first, you know, the TV had to go away because we couldn't have any kind of secular influence. You couldn't listen to the radio. And then music and dancing were an issue. And little by little, any kind of connection to anything rational or anything fun was gone. It rolled into the obsession with controlling women. And it's interesting, I will watch a documentary about any cult, because it always starts, the fucked up shit always starts with controlling women's bodies. And all of a sudden, you know, we had to have skirts that went over our knee, and then we had to have socks that went all the way up. And women, and really young girls, were responsible for male lust. So it was all about us getting ourselves right with God and taking away the temptation. And I was an attractive little girl. And I remember when I was like 11, the people in my parents' church, they started calling me Jezebel. And I didn't know who, like, I didn't remember the story. I don't know. I wasn't tracking it. And I remember reading it in the Bible of who Jezebel was and that she was a prostitute. And, you know, I was a virgin. I hadn't even kissed a boy. And I, all that feeling of being misunderstood and maligned and shamed. And when adults project their sexual dysfunction on children, it's very damaging, and it distorts their normal sexual development. I just remember feeling just sick to my stomach when I was around these people, for the way that they looked at me and how they made me feel. I was being taught in a one-room schoolhouse. That was a Church of God in Massapequa Park. And it was the main church room where we had Sunday services. They decided to start the school. And they literally took these long pieces of like particle board and like these long kind of like maybe a foot wide, but very long, maybe 20 feet long, attached them to the wall, and then put these little chains with little latches so you could like let down the desk. And then each child sat down, and there were these dividers, these big pieces of particle board that went between each child so you couldn't see each other. It was extreme isolation, and we couldn't read secular books. Everything had to be approved. Everything had to be the Bible or some kind of Christian author. And I remember they would have services, and they would talk about, you know, someday they're going to come for you. And I just remember thinking like, oh yes, the government, they're going to come for us. They're going to liberate us. And maybe that's what started my interest in law and being a lawyer and knowing how to protect myself and others in civil liberties. But I remember thinking like, that would be great. You know, like, and I remember thinking like, I just need someone outside of my parents in this church, in this cult, someone that cares, someone that can throw me a lifeline, some way for me to prove myself, to get me out. Because I knew that education was my future. I didn't care about crushes. I didn't care about boys. All I did was read every book I could get my hands on. I stole my neighbor's library card and I used to steal away and hide in the library stacks reading all kinds of fiction. Anything I could get my hands on that wasn't Christian. At a certain point, the one-room schoolhouse was too much negative influence. And then I ended up being taught at home. And really, my mom was a teacher, but she was always kind of preoccupied. She was always on the phone. And so she would just give me a stack of these, like, Christian, the PACE system, these little pamphlets with information on it. It was all about God and doctrinal things. There was no science. There was no limited math. And I remember at one point having a breakdown and just crying and saying, Mom, I don't even know what a cell is. I don't know basic information that I need to know if I'm going to go to college. And the look on her face told me everything. That was the whole point. The whole point of cults is codependency. And they educate the boys, but they rarely educate the girls, because the whole point is, like, keep them underfoot, keep them dumb, get them pregnant early, and off they go. And I watched a lot of suffering from the women around me. No birth control. You know, they were just pumping out babies without a lot of money. I'll never get this one woman who had just a psychotic break. She had her third child. Her husband was a dental hygienist. There was no money. You know, you're the person. He goes to work and you're the one who has to make lunch and put clothes on them and get them in school. And she just lost it. And I'll never forget June. June used to buy me Boston cream donuts on Sundays. And we would pick her up and a couple other people from the local assisted living Laurel Haven home and take them to church. And I remember her son was getting married and we were getting her ready and getting her hair done. And she had this big scar from the top of her skull down the side to the back. And I asked my mom, I said, what happened? She's like, oh, she had a surgery. And basically her husband fell in love with the babysitter and was having sex with her in their house. And she was very upset by it. They had four kids. And he treated her in such a way that he started saying, oh, she's crazy. And, you know, in those environments, women have no rights with respect to their health care. It's all decided for them. And so he had her lobotomized. And I'll never forget her and how that, the feeling I had as a little girl thinking that if I don't behave the right way, they'll cut a piece of my brain out. That I have to have, you know, non-consensual pregnancies and give birth until my mind and my body crash. It's so violent. And so I did everything I could to keep my head down. One day they did come for me. So I remember I was sitting at home and I think I was in my morning robe and I was reading some Christian books, dialing it in, you know. And this unmarked police car parked in front of my house with, and it had this little like red or, you know, emergency light, but it was on the dashboard. It was on the top of the car. And this guy got out and they walked into my parents' house and they said, you know, we're with the state and, you know, it's illegal to teach your child at home unless you approve the curriculum. And my parents, you know, like God told them, and they're not going to, you know, submit to, you know, secular government. So they took me out of the home and they brought me to the local high school and they said, we're going to give you a series of tests and we're going to see where you are from an educational level and what's going on. And I remember like being in the high school and it just seemed so big, the rooms and the hallways, and there were other kids my age. And it was so stimulating and so exciting. And they gave me all these tests. And a lot of it was like the English lit part of it. Like the math, I was like, I don't know. I'm always a good test taker. I'm good at multiple choice. But I remember there was some questions about Huckleberry Finn. And I remember thinking, like, okay, I don't know what this is about, but Huckleberry Finn sounds like a coming of age for a young boy. I'm going to say he's a boy because no one writes coming of age for young girls. And I really, like, flubbed my way, like, through some kind of essay, submitted all my stuff. They picked me up every day. It was like, I think, 4 days of testing. And a few months went by, and then my parents and myself, we were called into a social worker's office at the school. I mean, maybe she was a counselor. I don't know what the title would be. And she announced, she said, well, we have all of Carlin's scores. And she scored post-college on all of her subjects. And, like, I can't believe it. I felt like Socrates, where it's like, I don't think I'm intelligent till you go to the village square. Well, I didn't think I was intelligent because I didn't have a peer group. So I'm going, oh my God, I'm not dumb. I have a future. And my parents are elated. And I can't believe it. I really didn't see it coming. And it's because they felt that my intelligence and my ability to ace all of their tests proved that home instruction and raising a child with Jesus Christ everywhere around them, and it proved their religion. It proved their life choices. So then they took me in the room, the social worker, the woman, I'll never forget her. She had these beautiful kind of like platinum blonde whitish hair, and it was the 80s, and she had these big kind of triangle plastic earrings that were like purple and lipstick, and I never saw anything like that. Women did not wear makeup in the cult. You weren't allowed, and you weren't allowed to wear jewelry. So I'm already thinking she's amazing. And she said, well, Carlin, you know, you have to tell me what you want to do. And it was the first time, like, anyone asked my opinion about anything at all. And I'm 14, going on 15. And I said, well, what are my choices? What do you mean? What do I want? What do I want? I want to go to school. I want to go to college. And I need to prove that I'm not, you know, like, socially regressed in some way or limited, because that's what people are going to see if they read my story. So she said, well, they have this program at the local state university, SUNY Stony Brook. It's called the Young Scholars Program. And you have to take a test. And if you place well, you can take college courses now. And I was like, sign me up. This is exactly what I needed. This is really kind of the image of what I created in my mind. I'm like, I just need an opportunity, just a way to prove that I can do it. And I went home with the pamphlet. My parents thought it was great because now I'm really proving, like, I'm proof positive of their religion and why it's superior than being secular. And they told everyone in the church. And for the first time ever, I went from Jezebel to, like, almost revered in a way and respected. Like, people would look at me and smile instead of scowl. So here's the visual. Imagine my parents won't let me go to high school or junior high. But they pop me in the navy blue station wagon with an I Love Jesus bumper sticker on the back. And they drop me off at a college campus by myself. So they drop me off. So I've never even navigated, like, hallways in different classrooms. And now, like, there are different buildings everywhere. And I remember I had my schedule and I was taking a history class, the U.S. history since 1877, and trying to find my way to the building. Oh, I must have looked like a deer, like, in the headlights. I must have just... Oh, I find my way, sit down, and I'm in an auditorium. I mean, there are probably about 75 kids in that class. And I think everyone knows that I'm not a real student. Like, I'm not matriculated. Like, I'm 15 at this point. And I knew there was something better out there. And now I saw it. It was, like, amazing, the sense of liberty and freedom, and people looked different and they sounded different and they spoke different languages and were eating different food and had different clothes. You know, in a cult, everything's monolithic, everything's one note. And now it was just like diversity. I've always run to diversity. It's always been so exciting to me when someone's different. It's never fear that I feel at all. It's just like, oh my God, I want to breathe it in like fresh air. So taking my class, I would read everything twice. I just had to ace it. And I did. And I remember turning in my final paper, and it was the professor and TAs and a whole bunch of people milling around in the lecture hall. And when I submitted my final paper, I just said to him, and he said, oh, well, I hope I see you, you know, in this class, and what credits you, and he's asking me all these questions like I'm a full-time student. And I said, well, actually, I'm part of the Young Scholars Program. He could not believe it. He was like, what? You aced my class? You had the best paper. It was the first time that anyone had said anything positive about me or given me positive feedback for my intellect and my abilities. It was like sunlight on my skin. I loved it. There's one other moment that I wanted to share. I remember being in the stack studying, and I heard someone talking about Jimi Hendrix. And I said, who's Jimi Hendrix? And they all kind of laughed at me. They thought it was a joke. So I remember I went into the library, and I went up to the librarian, and I said, you know, I'd like to take out a book by Jimi Hendrix. She must have thought I was crazy. And she was very kind because she just smiled. She didn't laugh in my face, and she pointed me to the audiovisual section. And I remember taking out, I think it was an album, and they had these little, you know, record players with headphones. And I remember listening to Purple Haze for the first time, and it blew my mind. So after that, after having this experience that kind of built up my ego, it was only a year or two afterwards, before living with my parents became untenable and I ended up, you know, out on my own. And how I did it was I waited tables and I tended bar and I lied about experience. And I think when you're really young, you don't know better. You don't know failure. So you, like, looking at it now, I would never have done that. I would never take that risk. But I just was like, yeah, fine. And I ended up getting a car, an apartment, and I kept on taking classes. And then at a certain point, I matriculated. And then there was no doubt I was going to law school and drawn to civil rights and constitutional rights. So after law school, I worked at the Attorney General's Office, the Civil Rights Bureau in the Southern District of New York. I worked with a young attorney whose husband had started an internet company. He hired me to be general counsel, and I was like, the ink was wet. I think I just had gotten my bar results that I passed. That was a crazy ride. Tech raised $1 billion on Wall Street. I ended up kind of getting into digital media, and I had a company with two male partners, and we were building our company by rolling up assets from failed.coms. And it sounds very exciting, but it was very kind of dumb. But we had a great location in Soho, and we had studios, digital media studios. So a lot of people came through. And I remember one of the brands they had was this brand, Cherry Bomb. And it just got under my skin. I thought, wouldn't it be great to start a lifestyle brand for women where we really took on sexuality? Because the whole time I was a young lawyer and working for this tech company, women around me and like the wives of the executives, or, you know, I was the only female executive. So there wasn't any kind of sisterhood at that point. But women would always say, oh, you know, my husband speaks so highly. Everyone respects you, Carlin. But at the same time, you have this sex energy, you know, like, how do you balance it? Like, how do you do that? And, you know, I think some of us are just kind of born sex positive. I don't know. I don't know if it was maybe my rebellion, but I started just talking about it. I was like, wouldn't it be great if we just relaunched this? That would be so great. And we could have a site. And, you know, all I had was the brand Cherry Bomb. And then one day, Candida Royale came into the studio. She was filming a piece for Playgirl Television. And she, if you don't know who she is, she was a famous porn star in the 70s who then went out and started producing and directing her own films. So the whole point was she was producing adult media from a female perspective, the first feminist pornographer, and she was fantastic. So I hear she's in the studio, and I'm like, that's it. I'm meeting Candida Royale. I don't fucking care. So I remember rolling in the studio, and she was there, and I just put out my hand and said, I'm Carlin Ross, and I need to meet you, and gave her my whole pitch. That was it, right? The end of it. We didn't keep a connection. We didn't go back and forth. And then one day, this reporter from the New York Times called me, and she goes, we're looking for women who have professional backgrounds that are moving into the sex industry, and Candida Royale gave us your name. Solid thank you, Candida. She's no longer with us, but she was a good colleague and friend of a friend from afar. But, you know, women supporting other women, I'll always honor that, the role she played in my life. So I said, well, and I gave her kind of a pitch, you know, what am I doing? And it was all what I was going to be doing. I wasn't doing any of it. So she said, let's meet at blah, blah hotel and have some tea or coffee. So I meet her there and we're talking, and I can tell she doesn't know where to take the story. You know, it wasn't like she was just asking questions, and she was just throwing things out. She goes, you know, Carlin, why do you think that women as a group are going to be looking for sex product and sex media? And I said, well, it's simple. It's the anonymity of the internet. And this is back in 2004. Okay. So the internet was just getting started. I said, if you're, you know, in a small town, you're not going to go to the sex shop or go to a sex event, you know, or, you know, people can see you, shame, right? But if anonymously, I can go online, you're going to see women as a huge market. And we know that this is true today with the sexual wellness market. Women buy 80% of all sex products and media. And I knew in that moment, I kind of gave her the hook, but then that was that. And it was over. And she went her way, and I went back to my digital media company. And then a few months went by, maybe even 6 months, and I got an email from her and said, you know, it's going to be running in this edition. And on this day, February 20th, 2007, and I remember being with my roommate at my apartment on the Upper West Side, and we grabbed the morning paper, and I was looking for every place it could be. I went to the metro section. That's where they always put sex stuff. I'm looking, looking, looking. I'm folding over pieces. There's sheets of paper all over the floor. I can't find it. And I'm like, wow, did I get it wrong? Maybe it didn't run. Maybe they cut it. And then all of a sudden I folded over the front page and it says, women tailor the sex industry to their eyes. And there's a big picture of me. And it says, Carlin Ross decided to plot a new career. And I'm like, oh, like, oh my gosh, I can't believe it. It was the first time that a sex feature or sex article, an article about sex, had ever made it on the New York Times. I am outed and I'm still practicing law. And I have this media company. And here it is. I'm out. And I knew in that moment, the trajectory of my life had completely changed. And it wasn't, I mean, I guess it was consensual, but it just, I didn't see it coming. And I remember my partners really were upset about it. They did not like it at all, because everyone was calling with congratulations, and they didn't like that I was getting so much attention. They didn't mind when I was raising the capital or writing the prospectuses or the business plans, but they really resented that I had pulled out. So that was the beginning of the end of that partnership. And then I remember my personal life, being with my partner, and we were eating brunch on the street, 14th Street, and this woman passed and stopped. She goes, are you Carlin Ross? Oh my God, I read that article. It's the first. I saw the look on his face. I knew it was over. Then that night, I went out for drinks with friends, and the bartender was like, I saw you. And he came out. They had clipped the article out. It was this moment, you know, where everyone's like, wow, sex made it to the front page. And Betty said, when we finally met that Grant had done that. He had clipped it out and said, you have to know about this woman. You know, and I think, thank you, Grant, because it kind of planted a seed in Betty's mind that I was fucking cool. So this happens. What am I going to do next? Now everyone starts calling and start doing all these television interviews. And then Playgirl TV was like, hey, we want you to produce for us or do a show with us, a round table. And I thought, okay, this is all great, but I really don't know that much about sexuality. I know I'm orgasmic, but there is so much to know, and I'm not going to pretend that I'm an expert. So I thought, okay, what am I going to do? I'm still paying off my JD. I paid off my college. There was no mom and dad paying college or law school. It was on my own. So I had a small mortgage I was paying off. I thought, I can't get a PhD. It's like too much. So I thought, how am I going to like force myself to read all the books, to do all the work? And I thought, well, I could start a podcast series. And again, this is when podcasting wasn't like it is today, where everyone has a podcast. And I got some USB port microphones and a brand new MacBook Pro. And I thought, what I'll do is set up interviews with the greats. And then I'll have to read their books to be well informed. And I interviewed some people in the adult industry in the beginning to kind of get my feet wet. And I remember I Googled feminist plus NYC and Betty's name popped up. And Betty Dodson, the great and terrible Betty Dodson, lived 20 minutes from my apartment. I could not believe it. My podcast on iTunes had like a million downloads in 2 seconds. It was very popular. I called it Guilty Pleasures. And it was just interviews. It was just talking about sexual topics from a woman's perspective, you know, and it was really fresh because at that point, you know, our voices weren't even being heard. So I called Betty, got her machine, and I left a message saying I'd like to interview. And I dropped the million download number and I knew that would get her. And she called back in a few hours and we set up an interview. And just that first vision of Betty, and it was it. I was sold. I was in. I look back on it now and it was like, I had never met a woman in her power, a woman connected to her body and her sexuality, a woman that was sex positive with no neurotic loops and no bitterness and no passive aggressive patterns. She spoke her mind. She stood up tall. She was warm and she was fun and playful. It was just the mother that I had always wanted, the person I always wanted to connect with. So I look back at all of the struggle and the trauma and the sacrifice and, you know, all the negative things that can happen to young women and girls on their own in male-dominated authoritarian environments happened. And I look back on it and I now can feel gratitude because it's why when I'm doing the work, body sex, thank you, Betty, when I'm doing the work, I can relate to an immigrant woman. Because when you're in a cult, you don't know what's going on in the world around you. You're in a foreigner in your own country. I can relate to being a refugee and leaving with the money in my pocket, not knowing where I'm going to sleep. I know what it's like to be hungry and invisible and not having anyone in the world care if you live or die. And, you know, suffering creates empathy. For me, women made the difference. I wouldn't be here without Betty. I wouldn't be here without that social worker. It's those moments, the moments of generosity that can change one person's life and ripple out to hundreds of thousands of others.